Death is really a straightforward business, and while it may not be a pleasant subject to think or speak about, as of yet, I haven't heard of anyone being able to avoid us, unfortunately. So have you given any thought to what you'd like to happen to you and your belongings on your passing? Do you think you're too young to even think about things like that? When is the right time to think about making a will? Well, Principal Solicitor with Parker Law Solicitors in Waterford, Suzanne Parker, is on the line now to tell us more. Suzanne, thank you so much for doing this, first of all, and good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Jennifer?
I'm good. Why should people make a will?
Oh, everyone should have a will. It's one of those things when, if you own anything, you need a will. If you've got someone to take care of, you need a will. And a will, it only speaks from the date of death. So if you're trying to deal with anything before that day, you do it in a very different way. You tell your loved ones, you tell the people that are with you. But from the date of death, you need your will to speak for you, to say what you want to do and who you want to fulfill your wishes.
Okay. And at what age? I presume you have to be over 18 to make a will? I mean, is that the protocol? You do. Okay. Do you need a solicitor to make a will?
You don't. It is recommended, though, because problems happen so easily. Right. Now, back during COVID, we were sending out people instructions about how to make wills, and it's so regulated to make sure it's done properly, that people sign in the right place, that they're not overly stapled, little things like that, that it's witnessed correctly, that they're signed at the same time and everyone is in a room. And what if there's a question about it later? And somebody has to, maybe the probate office, come back with a question asking, what happened? Did the person have capacity? Was it witnessed properly? If it was the neighbour next door who you don't really know and has moved on somewhere else, there's nowhere to find them. But if it's the solicitor's office, there's always a way. We can track down Mary that worked in Henrietta Street 40 years ago. And if Henry wasn't, or Mary's not available, someone else is. And we can find that information, because you don't know when the problems are going to arise. It's not going to be today or tomorrow. It could be 50 years' time when somebody comes back with a question. But always, if there's a solicitor there with an attendance note and a file, there's a question, you know, it's a much stronger argument to say this person knew exactly what they were doing. They made it with sound mind. They had full information about it, and it was executed properly.
Okay. What information should it contain to make it legally binding?
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't have to say anything. Right. Your will can, it just has to follow a certain format. So what we recommend to go into a will are executors. So the executors are the people that you want to carry out your wishes. We always recommend two in case one can't act or one is unwilling to act, and you always got a backup. So we'd recommend two executors. We always recommend what the next thing is, what you want to happen to your assets. Who do you want them to go to? And then again, what if something happens? So say, for example, to a married couple with old children, but I'm not saying old. Okay, 20-year-old children,
yeah.
adult children. Mm-hmm. They want to leave everything to their adult children. But what happens if, everything to each other first. We're just presuming this beautiful married couple. And they leave everything to the adult children. What happens if one of the adult children pass away? Because this will, we want to make sure it follows them for 10 years, 20 years. They don't need to remake it every time something happens in their life and not worry about it. Obviously, you can. When there is a very big change in your life, keep changing your will. But they can put into it that they want their adult children to get it. And if something happens to one of them, does it go to their grandchildren? Does it go back to their surviving children? We try kind of make it to do the two steps as best as possible, just so there's something there if something happens.
If something happens,
everyone,
which is likely.
Yeah.
I just got a text in here, Suzanne. It says, hi, as a homeowner and a parent to a son who has Down syndrome, but we also have three other grown-up children, the thoughts of making a will is just so frightening for us. We can't seem to face this and keep putting it off. We could do with help in this area. So you would say, go see a solicitor, yeah?
Yes, and they are the very type of people that I would say would definitely need specialist information about it.
Okay.
And it's because with your adult children, every child is entitled to $335,000 tax-free from a parent, and that's just capital acquisitions tax, that's no problem. But when you have a child with some type of special needs, you want to set up some kind of a trust for him so that they're taken care of. Your other three adult children can be the trustees. You don't need to get anyone professional involved in it. You don't need to pay those kind of, but you can have it set up so the three of them are there, that they take the money for the fourth child and take care of it, and that side is exempt them for tax. if you follow specific rules and a few other things, but I won't go into that now.
Okay.
But that's the type of specialised area that I do think I
you
would
need
definitely
help.
Recommend. Give your solicitor a call, exactly.
Yeah, that's why it probably seems such a daunting thing to do. What other issues or problems do people come across when wills are being made or, in fact, in place?
Well, when they're making a will, the most important thing that we would say to people is make sure your family are aware of what you're putting in the will as best as possible. Now, you don't want to, some people don't want their people, they have no business in it, and that's fine. But if they're doing something in a will that nobody expects, so if you've decided instead of giving everything to your two children, you're giving everything to the dogs and cats home, there's going to be questions around it. Why this is happening, why you're not giving it to your relatives. Something like that. Just if you're doing something a bit strange, let the family know, because the last thing that you want is for the whole case and the whole probate to end up in litigation because your son and daughter are angry and frustrated and annoyed and really upset because something has happened they didn't expect. And that's just a very extreme version of it, but it could be the farm was meant to go to one person and it went to somebody else. Why was it done? Just let them know. There could be tax reasons, there could be a lot of reasons. And if you don't want the family to know in advance, make sure your solicitor fully understands, has a really good attendance. And it's all because the only people that will benefit from that later are going to be the solicitors and the barristers and the lawyers who spend the day in court or, you know,
yeah,
trying to litigate it. But they're not the people that should win in this in any way.
And is that what happens then? I mean, if let's say if I died tomorrow, sorry, touch wood. If I died tomorrow, and I don't have a will, what happens? What happens to my house and my car or whatever that I own?
There's something under the Succession Act that we have here from the 60s, the rules of intestacy go. So if you die without a will, you've died intestate. Now, it makes things a little bit more difficult. So say you've got your house and your car and everything. You have an administrator. So the administrator would be the next in kin. So your spouse would probably be the person that would be the next in line to take over as administrator and carry out your actions. Now, they don't have the same powers as an executor would. So an executor is somebody named under a will that is specifically given the powers. An administrator doesn't have the powers under the will, but has the powers under the legislation. They need to wait till they have that yellow piece of paper from the probate office to actually be able to do anything. An executor can start lining up selling property and transferring property and things like that, but they can't finish it until they have the grant. An administrator doesn't have those powers until the courts give them the piece of yellow paper that says, you are entitled to have this grant.
And does that cost money to get done, and time and effort and stress, I presume?
Yes.
Yeah.
And so say for your case, and even something I had to do for someone recently, was we had to blanket most of Waterford, Kilkenny and Tipperary to see if somebody had a will for this person, because we didn't know if there was one made or not. So that's the first thing. And that's, it's one email going out, but it's one email going out to maybe 200 or 300 firms and 200 or 300 responses being checked coming back. That's not something you want to do. If you have a will, it should be you should be known and have a copy in your house. Let the executors know that you have a will. So it's a little bit more work around that. Now, getting an administration is a little bit more expensive than getting a grants probate. Some grants probate could take 3 or 4 hours work, and solicitors charge differently for everything. We all have our own way of doing things. We charge hourly. Other solicitors charge percentage. Sometimes it works out the same. Sometimes it works out very different. So you can't even kind of judge that. But just with an administration, it is more work because there's a lot more steps involved to get to the actual grants probate or the letters of administration. But the people that will get your assets under your will are very structured and very set out in the legislation too. So if you are married with no children, your spouse gets everything. If you are married and you have children, your spouse gets 2/3 and your children will get 1/3. Now, that could work out very awkward for you because your spouse could get 2/3 and then you could have minor children getting 1/3. And you've no trust set up in no will, and it just makes it messy and costly.
How do you set up a trust?
Well, you can put a trust. A lot of wills that we do at the moment actually have trust in them. And they could be quite simple trusts that say, we want the assets for the minor children held in trust by my executors until the age of 18 or 21.
Okay.
And it's quite easy. They put it on post and wait for them to get to 18 or 21.
Oh, it's as easy as that. Okay, a lot of texts coming in on 51552 because they're getting free advice. They say, here's one. If you don't have an up-to-date will, does it really matter if it's ultimately going to the same people anyway?
It depends. Now, so technically that will could be up to date if nothing has changed in the circumstance. Mm-hmm. And you might need to have a look at it to see, are the executors still there? Are the executors still happy to act? Are the beneficiaries still there? Do you still like the same people as you wanted to give the money to the first time around? And if that's the case, then that will is perfect.
Question for the solicitor. Can you name someone as an executor and leave them some money or property in your will?
Yeah, you can, of course.
Okay.
The only thing, there's certain things they can't. So the people that witness the will, if they're named as an executor, they can't benefit under the will. So whatever you do, if you're making a home will, and please don't, if you can, whoever's witnessing it, make sure they're not named as a beneficiary under the will, because then that gift will be void.
Okay. If you want your children, another text, if you want your children to be looked after by someone in particular, can other family members contest that?
That's a big enough issue around guardianship. So it depends on the other family, the family that wants to get involved, and it depends on who you name. The parent is the legal guardian, and they can name a legal guardian under their will that they want to take over the guardianship. Any family member can contest anything under any grounds, but it would have to have good reason to do it. That's kind of jumping into kind of the family law aspect of wills as well. I wouldn't, if they're looking for specific advice about that,
family law,
talk to the solicitor. Mm. But it could be the case that nobody will ever, they won't find out if there's going to be an issue with that until they're gone. All they can do is the best for their children now about naming a guardian and naming two guardians as well, and setting up a trust for minor children too.
Okay. That's the basics and sounds completely logical. Here's a long one. Okay, so brace yourself. Yeah. My boyfriend and I are hoping to buy an apartment. My parents also want to inherit their house to me down the line. So our plan is to build an extension on their house in the next year or so and live there so we can inherit tax-free in years to come. If my name is on the apartment that we buy, will I have to pay inheritance tax? Or if my boyfriend buys the apartment in his solo name and we're married when I inherit my parents' house, will we still be liable for inheritance tax even if we've lived there for the relevant amount of time to inherit tax-free?
There are about six different queries in the middle of all of that. Like, yeah. So ownership and capital. You know what? If they want to even send me a quick email, I'll talk to them.
Okay.
And it's because there are dwelling house relief exemptions going on there. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, first time, but there's 100 different things that are probably not even linked up with wills, but they're linked up with the inheritance side of things, and also kind of a lot of property law, which we can help in. Look, send me a quick email and I even give
you
a call.
And go through it. Okay.
I will.
Here's the last one. Hi, Jen. What happens if a couple are unmarried but own a home?
A few things there. So under their will, so it depends on what they want to do. If an unmarried couple buy a property together, we always register them as tenants in common. And what that means is that they both own 50% each. There's a separation there. Mm-hmm. If it's a married couple, we use joint tenancy and survivorship applies. So if one passes away, it straight away goes over to the second couple. That's fine. Or the second person. But when there's a joint tenancy, it means that each person own their 50% slightly independently. Now, they can't cut a house line down the middle of the house, but they can will away their 50% of it in whatever way they want. So if they want to will it to their family, they can. If they want to will it to each other, they can also do that. Now, the other person would get this dwelling house relief that the other people were asking about, as long as they don't own any other property and a husband or principal private residence, they live together, as long as they fit all the rest of the criteria, so there won't be tax. So generally, an unmarried couple will be considered strangers in blood. So it will be only 16,500 they could get tax-free from each other. So that's why you have to use this dwelling house relief.
Okay.
Because you could be looking at a house for, say, 400,000 and they're getting a gift from a stranger of 200,000. And that's why. But it depends on what they want to do. If they want to make sure their own parents get the property or get their 50% or get bought out, then they can do that. And it could be the case that most people with mortgages have life insurance to cover to pay off the mortgage if something happens to either party. So the mortgage will be cleared when the person passes away, but their 50% ownership will either go to their parents or their partner, depending on what they put into their will. Have a will.
Get a will. I mean, that's the bottom line, isn't it? Oh, so what about joint bank accounts? If you have a joint bank account with a spouse, how does that just automatically go if you're deceased? It goes to the other person entirely?
A joint bank account with a spouse is fine. It goes straight over with a death certificate. Now, a joint bank account with somebody else, you need to clarify why it was in joint names, if and who would have. So say me and you had a bank account together, absolutely no reason, and you were putting all the money into it for me. Then in that case, and you passed away, I couldn't kind of say automatically, oh, I have a full entitlement to that. I need to justify why it was there. Is this a gift coming over to me? Is there a presumption that it was there always for me to get the benefit of it? So while a spouse's joint account is quite easy, you can say, yes, it'll transfer over and that's fine. If it's somebody else you're holding a joint bank account or a joint post office account, a lot of people would put a second person on the account, just the signatory for ease of access. There's always a question around why that was done and who put the money in and who should benefit from it.
Okay. Can we talk about tax for a second?
Yeah.
What are the tax consequences of a will?
Well, the will itself doesn't cause tax. And in Ireland, what we do is we don't tax the will. Other countries have inheritance on the will. We tax the individual beneficiary. So the person that's getting the benefit from the will are the person that would have the, and it's called capital acquisitions tax. That would be for, say, a spouse, there's no tax whatsoever. For a child, it's £335,000.
Tax-free
completely. And this is a lifetime threshold. And what I'm doing right now, I'm just Googling thresholds so I don't get the numbers wrong. Mm-hmm. 335, I know, is children, so we're fine with that.
Yeah.
It's £33,500 for a group B. So that would be a niece, a nephew, a brother, a sister, anyone in that line, sorry, £32,500, apologies. And then a stranger in blood is £16,250. So under your will, say you give €335,000 to a child, €32,500 to a grandchild, and €16,250 to the neighbour next door. That will is technically tax zero. Yeah, there's no tax being paid by anybody on that will. But it's when you go over those thresholds that it would become taxable. Now, each beneficiary, it capital acquisition tax in Ireland, is a self-assessment tax. So each person would need to. So if you receive £335,000 from one parent and then the second parent tries to give you something, that's straight away taxed at 33%. And there's no way around that because it's a lifetime threshold. Mm. There's a couple of little things about giving entire benefits up to a parent and a deceased spouse stepping into the shoes. So there's a couple of little things that if there's any specialist advice people needed, you can look at that. But generally, they're the rules and it's a lifetime threshold.
Okay. Now, I want to talk about something else. Enduring power of attorney. We actually got a text in about this, saying myself and my partner are not married and aren't going to anytime soon. We've two children. I'm concerned something might happen health-wise. Can a will give me or my partner power of attorney for health decisions in a hospital? So first of all, what is enduring power of attorney?
Okay. A lot of people are not familiar with a power of attorney. You can give to somebody, anyone to do anything for you, while you have capacity. An enduring power of attorney steps in when the person has lost capacity. Now, a lot of people that have done enduring powers of attorney, the law on this is changing very much over the last while. But under the old system of the enduring power of attorney, you'd go into your solicitor's office, you'd give people the power, and this is giving them the power to make decisions on your behalf.
When you're of sound mind?
No. You have to have lost sound mind. You've got to make the actual enduring power of attorney when you have capacity and sound mind, but you can only get it registered when you've lost capacity. So there's two stages to it. And the first stage is an easy enough process. Now everything has changed over the last couple of months and probably people are watching in the news and in the legislation, and it's not the same process. And it only came in a couple of months ago that all the solicitors are all up in arms about this because we're trying to get our heads around the new way of doing things. And if everything is online and people can fill in the documentation themselves, and then they've got to go to a solicitor and get the form signed to go to a doctor. So there's an awful lot. It's great for people being able to fill in all of the information themselves, but you still have to get your solicitor and your doctor involved. So generally the process would be that when you are fit, healthy and sound mind, you complete the paperwork. You get signed off to say, I have legal capacity, I have mental capacity, and then the paperwork sits there and it waits until the day that somebody has decided you've lost capacity. And that's when the registration has to begin. And at the moment, anyone that has EPAs in place that have done them under the old system, that registration goes to the ward of court's office, and it does take an awful lot of time to go through. And it should. It takes away somebody's civil liberties. You're actually saying to a person, you can't deal with any of your own bank accounts, you can't deal with your own information anymore. So there has to be a strict enough process, and it does take 5 weeks from the for you've got to serve people to give them time to appeal it as well. Because if I got somebody served it on me, I would want time to refuse it. But it's a quite an in-depth, and I would say if anyone's thinking about doing them, go to a solicitor and actually look at the process properly under the new system, because the old system is gone. But if anyone's parents or anyone already has an enduring power of attorney, nothing has changed. We can still register that in the old in the same system as we always did.
Okay. Now, Suzanne, why would somebody get an enduring power of attorney or a power of attorney when they have instructions in their will, so to speak? What's the difference?
Well, the enduring power of attorney is while you're still alive. That they could, and they deal with things about, it could deal with anything, your health decisions, your what you wear, where you what hairdressers you get your hair done on a Saturday, all of those things, because it could be somebody with dementia or Alzheimer's that can't or doesn't know this anymore. So you're making decisions. The will only takes effect on the date of death. So anything that happened under the enduring power of attorney is gone. Whoever you named as your attorney is gone. Your executors are now the people with the power.
Oh, okay. That makes complete sense. But what if, let's say someone goes to hospital, they've been diagnosed mm-hmm. with Alzheimer's, for example, and the doctor calls their next of kin. Surely the next of kin would have the same authority and power as power of attorney. Like, what's the difference between being a next of kin and a power of attorney?
Sometimes next of kin. Now, with a married couple, I know that the next of kin can make nearly all the decisions and the doctor will listen to them, but the doctor is always under an obligation to do what's best for the patient, even with the next of kin. It's the same with the enduring power of attorney, but what if you're the attorneys that you're appointing is not actually your next of kin? So, you know, maybe it's one of your nieces or nephews. It's not your spouse or it's not your children. How do you know? And an enduring power of attorney can deal an awful lot with financial things that a next of kin might, the banks might just say, no, we can't talk to you about this at all. So medical-wise, and there's a grey area there between what a doctor and patient, what, you know, who can give advices and who can speak to a doctor about something as a next of kin, what information can be handed over. But the enduring power of attorney would have a very similar stance as a next of kin, but it could be a different person completely.
Okay. Okay. So it is advisable if you're in a partnership, maybe more so than married?
Well, we do recognise... We do ask people or advise people to make enduring powers of attorney either way.
Okay.
Now, and but it's usually the case that it comes to when somebody is getting a diagnosis or they have early onset of something, that's the time that they're rushing to go ahead and do something about it. That might be a little bit too late. If there's a history in your family or anything like that, try and look at it and kind of just so you have all the options. And it's more so... You can make your own personal care decisions. The executor or the attorney that you're appointing, they know you, they know what you want. Because I remember years ago, there was wards of courts involved and people were making decisions about things that were solicitors and me. I didn't know this lady and I didn't know what was best for her. And we were trying to get information from the family, but that's not what you want. You want the people that care about you to make your decisions and help you still be you.
Yeah. Well, it seems like a good thing to do, and it's time and I suppose money that we don't want to spend, but in the end it makes everyone's life a lot easier. Somebody just texted in saying, is our US will, living trust, power of attorney recognised in Ireland, or do we need to make a new one over here?
The US will, and if it follows the criteria, and if you have Irish assets. Now, what I recommend generally is having a will based in every country you have assets, but also making sure each will doesn't revoke the last will. So you could put at the top of your will, I am hereby revoking all former wills, and that revokes every will everywhere in the world. It needs to make sure that it's only revoking Irish wills and dealing with Irish assets, because you could cause an absolute mess given the residue of your worldwide assets when you've got US property. The living will, that's a set of wishes, and that would be valid here. And what was the last argument? A power of attorney, I would question that, whether it falls. You'd have to actually look at the paperwork to see if it would comply with Irish law, and if it, because it might more than likely, a lot of stuff with the US is very specialised, and very specialised documents and even legislation that it's based on. And if it's not notarized properly, then you probably won't be able to use it in Ireland. And if it's not, there's a lot of kind of things you'd have to look at around that.
Okay.
But make a will if you have a house in Spain, or if you have a house in, especially the UK at the moment because of Brexit, do put a will in place wherever you have assets.
Suzanne, we're getting so many texts in. So I just want to direct them to your website so they can annoy you and not me. But honestly, tell them to brace themselves. But honestly, I think if you have any concerns, and I suppose conversations like this kind of unearth things that are in the back of our head that we put off for so long, but it's so important to deal with because you don't want to be in a situation that is going to cost you time and money. Get things in place now. But thank you so much, Suzanne, for coming on the show today. What is your website if people need you? In any capacity.
We're www.parkerlaw.ie, and the girls in the office are probably going to kill me, but go ahead and ring them.
They're going to kill you. They're definitely going to kill you when I read out the next text, because it says Suzanne Parker is a legend, helped me with my dad's will after he passed in January. She's a complete lifesaver. That's from Damien in Waterford. Suzanne, thank you for all your help today, hopefully we'll chat to you soon. Okay.
We would, of course. Thanks,
bye, Suzanne. Bye. You too. Bye-bye. There we go. Very, very helpful stuff. Thank you for your text messages in on 51552. We might ask Suzanne if she wants to come back another time and do a Q&A, because I know you guys have a lot of questions. I think the moral of the story is you can always ask your local solicitor for advice. And if you're any way in doubt over anything like this, do seek good, solid, sound advice. Jen Zamparelli on RTE 2FM.